Hello, everyone, and a very pleasant good afternoon to you wherever you may be. Bruce Ash, along with Eb Wilkinson, welcoming you to a special Memorial Day weekend edition of Inside Track. Thanks for tuning in today. Eb Wilkinson, our producer John Couch, and I all wish you a very peaceful and reflective Memorial Day weekend. This is a time when we do reflect on the lives of all of our soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and guardsmen who have made the ultimate sacrifice, not only in defense of our country, but freedom and liberty throughout the world. The essence of America can be defined by the sacrifice of so many gallant men and women who have worn our country's uniform. One such man was Tucsonan Martin Barreras. On May 6, 2014, local hero Command Sergeant Major Martin Barreras was wounded in a firefight in Herat Province, Afghanistan. Several days later, he succumbed to his injuries at the San Antonio Army Medical Center. Sergeant Barreras moved to Tucson as a youth in 1974 and graduated from Sunnyside High School. He led a virtuous life and served with his Bobcats, as they called him, of the 2nd Battalion, 3rd Brigade Combat Team in the 1st Armored Division. But prior to his 22 years of U.S. Army service, Barreras was a Marine for 6 years. The man his troops referred to as Gunny participated in the rescue of Private Jessica Lynch in 2003. The U.S. Army had named him a year earlier as a top enlisted soldier. Command Sergeant Major Barreras was my friend. I believe that I was the luckiest battalion commander in the Army to have him as my Command Sergeant Major, said Lieutenant Colonel Edward Brady. This man would do absolutely anything and everything to ensure his soldiers came home safely. Unfortunately, Barreras was not so fortunate himself. He is survived by his parents, his wife, 3 children, and grandchildren. He served with distinction. Sergeant Major Martin Barreras deserves our honor, along with all the Arizonans whose lives and service we reflect on this Memorial Day weekend. As always, thank you, our listeners, so much for supporting our great Inside Track sponsors. Imus Wilkinson Asset Management, Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus, and Corazon Cabinets. These are great local companies you should do business with. We welcome your calls to the Imus Wilkinson Asset Management Live Line at 790-2040. So, John, let's go ahead. We're going to take a real quick break, an early break, to hear messages from our advertising partners. And when we return, we will spend the rest of the hour with, I think you will agree, a very, very special guest, former Congressman Duncan Hunter Sr. Welcome back. We have a great show for you today. Vietnam veteran, Army Ranger, attorney, former 14-term U.S. House member, chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, 2008 presidential candidate, friend of the U.S. Constitution, friend of the show and its founder, Emil Franzi. It is my pleasure, and I know Eb's pleasure, to welcome Duncan Hunter Sr. to Inside Track. It's been some time since you've joined us. Sir, welcome back.
Hey, great to be with you guys. And yeah, I just walked out of a great town hall meeting here in Ramona, California, about 30 miles north of San Diego, where Duncan and I were doing a back and forth on the border fence and the border security issues in general. So it's I told him I had a very important talk show to get to, and so I'm now in my car in Ramona, California, great little country town, not too far away from you guys.
I've spent a fair amount of time in Ramona. My wife and I have a house in the San Diego area, so we get around. You were a great friend of this show's founder, Emil Franzi. I cannot tell you how proud he was of your friendship and how much he looked forward to your occasional Tucson visits and phone calls. We talked about him all the time.
Oh, that's neat of you to say that. The last time I was with Emil, I was driving through, and I gave him a buzz, and he came down and met me at the Denny's right off of 10, and we had a great, a wonderful time together. And what a fabulous guy. He had such a sense of the past and American history and such a concern for our country. And I know you shared that affection for Emil. A wonderful, wonderful person.
Yeah, he was quite a character. You know, Emil told me, and maybe it wasn't this time that you just described at the Denny's, but I think it was. You had a meat cooler in the trunk of your car or in your truck, and yeah. He told me that you whooped out some fresh game that you had.
I think that was venison.
Yeah. That was such a great story. That was a great story, Congressman. It's,
hey, you can eat cheap if you're going across the country if you shoot your own game. But let me tell you, I would never stoop to picking up roadkill.
It's not that bad.
Yeah, that's Ab Wilkinson saying that he eats roadkill all the time.
Well, it's a good work if you can. You know, I hate to digress, but actually in Alaska, you can get on a rotating list, and when somebody kills a moose or a caribou, the game warden will deliver it to you. And I know one guy who's now a great scientist whose great opening line is, "I was raised on roadkill," because he and his mom was a single mom, and they had five boys, and they literally grew up on moose and caribou that, courtesy of Fords and Chevys going a little too fast in some areas.
Yeah. Congressman, you served in Vietnam. You served with and lost friends and comrades. Can you share with our listeners any reflections this Memorial Day on their service and some of these men and women that didn't make it home?
The sacrifice of our people in uniform is as close to the example of Jesus as you can get, because it's sacrifice without condition. It's people that today, even, and we've got an ongoing war against the terrorists in a number of places around the world, but it's people being out, being away from their families, hardship conditions, and I had an easy tour in Vietnam, but I knew a number of really great heroes. It's putting yourself out, exposing yourself to danger, while the folks back home are living a good life in America and enjoying the freedom, and it's just such an important part of our country. You know, the only reason great civilizations are able to survive is because they have people who, when the enemy is at the gate, would go out and meet them. And I was never so proud as I was when my son, Duncan, when we were attacked on 9/11, I had no idea that he was going to join the Marine Corps. He quit his job that day, called Mom and I up on the phone and said, "Those people didn't deserve to die. I'm joining the Marines." And he went out and did two tours in Iraq and one in Afghanistan. But there's a ton of young men like him and women who go out and again, the greater love hath no man than he who lays down his life for a friend. And many of these people laid their lives down for people they will never meet, who enjoy a life that is much more pleasant than any that they ever had. But because they are there, we are here, and we are free.
Yeah, you know, there's a fellow in town in his radio show. He says, "We're the home of the free because we're also the land of the brave."
That's it.
You know?
That's it.
So that's a great story about Duncan Jr. when he decided to join the Marines, and Duncan Jr. also served with distinction during his time in the U.S. Marines. When you joined the Army, and you were an Army Ranger, if I'm remembering right, Congressman, what was your mindset? I mean, and what year did you enter service?
It was 1969, I had a 1.8 grade average or a 1.9 grade average with the University of California. They were glad to see me go, I'm sure. But I, you know, my dad served in World War II, and my uncle and a cousin was killed in Korea, and we hunters kind of join all the wars. We go to all the wars, and so I wanted to get over there. I was inspired by a lot of folks that I knew who were involved in that war, and Vietnam was a noble cause, it's been twisted largely by the people who didn't go, who want a different historic perspective. But from the beginning of the world to the end of the world, there was only one time when they had free elections in Vietnam, and that's when the Americans were there. And the lie that had been put to the American people, which was that these Vietnamese North and South just wanted to reconcile. They all wanted that good communist dictatorship, and then the Americans were in their way. That was not true, because after the war was over, we had left. And incidentally, when the North invaded the South and came down and took South Vietnam, the American line forces, our infantry divisions, had been gone for 4 years at that point. They were all back home. But those people, we had this ton of boat people. All of a sudden, we realized half of Vietnam was trying to swim after us because, one, Americans are great ambassadors. That's our soldiers and sailors and airmen and Marines are our greatest ambassadors. They make great friends. But those people knew that we were a land of freedom. And that's why people would push off in a shrimp boat, and a leaky shrimp boat, out of the South China Sea and try to get to some place where they could get to America ultimately. There's never been a war that was surrounded by more propaganda from the left than Vietnam. But those who served were people of great honor. And the cause of Vietnam, spreading freedom and helping a country that wanted to be free, is a very noble cause.
You know, and it's interesting, in Vietnam today, the economy is booming. There's industry, there's modern cities. It sort of has all of those, the cultural and historical significance that it had, for hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of years. But now it also has a form of capitalism and actually a government that's, regularly rather friendly to the United States.
Well, and there's an old saying that governments don't have friends, they have interests.
Right.
And of course, the United States is a hedge against the Chinese, who, as you know, at one point invaded Vietnam had a little a mini war with Vietnam. But, you know, the communist leaders are still as brutal as ever. They still execute people they don't like. And there's a great if you look at what's happened in communist China, for example, they send their regimented workforce to the factories, and they've broken the code that brings capitalist nations in. You can set up your factory in Vietnam or in China, and you can produce. They will supply you with lots of workers who don't complain, and you can set up your production line probably without even missing a pace in the market. But the people at the top, that is the people who decide, it's still a centralized government,
a socialist
government, a communist government, and the people at the top do what they want. So the capitalists can come in and get product out of Vietnam as long as they don't rock the political boat or attempt to take any power from the centralized government that holds it.
Congressman, it's been 11 years. I think it's been 11 years since you left Congress. What are the biggest changes since then? And have these changes benefited our country?
Well, if you're looking at the big picture, the 40,000 foot picture, the country, the Democrat Party has gone markedly to the left. And I think that's sad. You know, a lot of my colleagues who have conservative points to make, my fellow conservatives, they say, boy, that's going to be an easy target. But I hate to see the conservative Democrats being elbowed aside and the new leftists coming in who really are leftists. And I'll give you an example. You know, Dianne Feinstein is one of the most liberal members of the U.S. Senate, and proudly so. Dianne Feinstein was voted down by the California Democrat Party in their nomination process, which has nothing to do with the official nomination. But she lost like 3-1 in their preference vote. And they claimed that Dianne Feinstein was too, quote, too conservative. Now, she's one of the most liberal members of the U.S. Senate, but her own party leaders in California, who are really fringe people, said she's a conservative. And so that's the guy that was a liberal 10 years ago is now considered a conservative by some of these folks that are far to the left. And, you know, a number of political philosophers talked to the effect in the old days. They said democracy will never work because once people realize they can vote themselves benefits, then we're just going to be like a cocaine addict and we're going to self-inject spending until we blow up, until we die. And Americans, to their credit, always realized that was a false philosophy and Americans were tough enough to know that and free enough and individualistic enough to know that the guy that simply says he's going to give you a bunch of free stuff is ultimately going to get it from you, and it's not going to be free, and it's not going to work, and it's going to destroy the system. So that always held back the guys that just promised free stuff. In fact, George McGovern, when he was going down like a rock against Richard Nixon, his advisors had him come up with a plan whereby he said, I'm going to give $1,500 free to everybody above a certain income level, and I'll take it, or below a certain income level, and I'll take it from the people above that level. Free money. And when they took a poll on it, they discovered that people below that level, that turned them off. And when they polled them and asked them, why are you against getting this free money? They're going to take it from a rich guy. They said, listen, I may not make enough money to get that $1,500 or to be above that level right now, but I may be someday. And so Americans knew instinctively that just the people that offered them free money were preaching a false song. Today, I think things are moving markedly to the left in a lot of areas.
In our Gallup poll, 40% of Americans in this recent Gallup poll said that they sort of like socialism.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? And you know, if you look at the socialist experiment, that's exactly what I'm saying. The socialist experiment worldwide has failed miserably. The North Koreans are eating the bark off the trees. You know, the USSR, Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, now fractured by Reagan, but still manifest with that philosophy. You know, the Nazi Party, that's German for National Socialist Party.
Right.
They all require a dictatorial central government, and that kills an economy, because the real makers of the economy are the millions and millions of people working on their own initiative to bring bread to their own family. And ironically, those people end up also being the most generous in giving bread out of their own free will and giving charity to those who are unfortunate, who don't have it. So freedom has not only brought prosperity to a ton of people who have earned money, it's also brought a form of prosperity to a lot of people who didn't have any money, who are the beneficiaries of people that work hard and share what they have out of their own goodwill.
Congressman, we're going to take a couple minutes here for some commercial messages from our advertising partners. When we come back, I'd like to get your thoughts on how the California Republican Party comes back in the 2020 elections and then get into a discussion regarding the border crisis we have. So if you'll hang with us, Congressman, we're down to the half hour mark. We'll come right back with Duncan Hunter Sr. You're listening to Inside Track. Welcome back to Inside Track. Our guest, Duncan Hunter Sr. Congressman Hunter, 2018 was a rough year for California Republicans in the House races. We got blown out of several seats that we had held for decades. How does the Republican Party plan to come back in California? And also, how do we hold seats such as your son's in the 2020 election?
In Southern California, in the two major Reagan counties, that's San Diego County and Orange County, you're exactly right. We had six Republican seats, solid seats. We lost five of them. The only one who won was my son, and everybody else was blown out. And what was interesting was election night, with 100% of the precincts in, those guys were all ahead.
Yeah.
And tens of thousands of so-called provisional ballots were, quote, harvested the next day and came in, and most of them ran 2-1 against the Republican. And those people, for example, Mimi Rogers in Orange County, she was ahead by 6,000 votes after all the votes were in election night, and then she lost the next day on provisionals. I don't know what happened on those provisionals. It's very hard to understand it. So I don't know exactly what happened with them. So I don't know what they're going to do, but they've got to find out first. They've got to find out. A gentleman just walked by to ask me if I need a tow here. I've got my car parked on the side of the road. Very nice of him. But we've got to find out what they did election night. And I
counted how many ballots they needed to get.
Yes, and whether people were actually allowed to vote other people, because there were thousands of people lined up at the election headquarters after the on election night, well after the polls had closed. And the question was, did they have bundles of votes? Were they voting other people? And I hope that the party was going to investigate and try to find out what led to the massacre. But we have to find out, for example, a provisional ballot is a ballot that you would cast if you couldn't get home in time to your home precinct. You're 40 miles away and it's 10-8. You walk into another precinct and say, I want to vote here because this is in my district, even though it's not my polling place. And they'll let you vote provisionally. But 20,000 people shouldn't do that.
Right.
And why would a person vote across town when his own polling place is two blocks away? So there's a lot of unanswered questions. So first thing is, we need to know what happened. But secondly, our party needs to have, I think, and I'm giving you my unvarnished opinion, I'm very pro-life. And I think that that is one of the appealing values to the growing Hispanic community in the United States. And it's one that the Republican Party does not lead with. I think we should lead with that. And I've got friends like Bill Redman in New Mexico, who won in massively heavy Democrat districts by working the values issues and campaigning on values. I think there's a value there.
Well, and you,
so I think that's one thing we have to do.
Congressman, you were way ahead of most Republicans on the issue of life when you served, because if I recall, you actually had proposed legislation that would have given citizenship rights, constitutional rights to unborn children while still in utero. And that was an idea that was, especially at the time, way ahead of the rest of the world.
Well, I was trying and have always been trying to make the point that unborn children have value. And it's amazing to see people who see value in a little baby furry seal,
right,
and yet they can look at an unborn child with fingers and toes and all those features and say, no, that has no resemblance to a person.
Well, and the Democratic...
There's no personhood there. There's no value there.
And the Democratic Party has gone so far in at least two states, in Virginia and in New York State, of passing and approving legislation at the governor's desk, legislation that would have allowed infanticide. I mean, it is incredible that we are where we're at on this issue of life. It really is a life or death sort of a proposition that the Democrats have put before us.
It's a slippery slope.
Yeah, it sure is.
When you pull away, when you start stripping unborn children of their value as human beings, it's a shorter step to say that perhaps old people who have lived a long life don't need to stick around and any longer. That's a conclusion the liberals can come to, and that's manifest in some of the health systems of the world, where you get certain operations if you're of a certain age, but when you reach a certain age, you are divested of the right to have those operations, and on the basis that you should fall gently from the tree like a leaf in winter, and that is a natural progression from the devaluing of life with respect to unborn children.
Yeah, you're right.
And they were going that, Duncan, this is Eb, and they were going that way with the death panels also, even though they're not calling them the death panels. That's exactly what they were.
Yeah, Eb, you're exactly right.
Congressman, you probably agree with former Obama DHS Chief Jay Johnson, who said recently that we really do have an immigration crisis. But in your area of the world, in Southern California, you really did see a significant reduction in illegal entries and much better border enforcement because a wall was built. It is incredible today that we have the problems that we have with tens and hundreds of thousands of illegals entering this country, and the Democrats still won't call it a crisis for the most part.
Yeah, you know, since January, we've had, I think, 304,000 illegal entries up through April. They haven't got the May figures in. The U.S. Marine Corps is approximately 175,000 people plus. So that means that an army twice the size of the U.S. Marine Corps has come in the last 4 months into this country. If that's not a crisis, I don't know what a crisis is. And so you've got this massive migration. In fact, if you look at 300,000 people, a ton of those folks are coming from Guatemala. If you did a poll right now in Guatemala, in the cities and villages of Guatemala, the entire country wants to come here. So in the last 4 months, we've had the equivalent of 10 cities with 30,000 inhabitants for each city totally transplanting into the United States. That's the number of people who have come in. Now, they're not all, obviously not all from Guatemala, but a massive number of them are. And yes, we did stop illegal immigration in the corridor, which was the most prolific
right. Smuggling
corridor in the U.S. for people and for drugs. That's the 15 miles between the Pacific Ocean and the coastal hills between Tijuana and San Diego. And we built the double fence. I built that thing with earmarks because presidents didn't like it. Mexico would complain vociferously, but we reduced smuggling by more than 95% of both drugs and people. And the crime rate in San Diego by FBI statistic after I finished the double border fence, the crime rate fell by 54.3%. By FBI statistic. That means we cut crime, murder, rape, robbery, almost in half. In fact, we cut it by more than half. because we took away the mobility of the border gangs, which were coming across at night. And we put the double fence in with a Border Patrol road in between. They lost their ability to transit the border quickly, and it put them out of business.
Well, today we have this chaos along the border. And can you, is there any explanation that you can give why Democrats in Congress and in state legislatures obstruct efforts to control illegal immigration? And I mean, is there any chance of getting a bipartisan solution at this point in time? I mean, it seems like all they want to do is investigate the president, but we don't seem to
the answer.
I'm sorry?
It's all political. And Bruce, I can tell you for this reason, it's easy to look at the when I offered the bill to extend the San Diego border fence 853 miles across the main smuggling areas of Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. In 2006, I wrote that bill. It was attached to a big bill. It passed the House and the Senate heavily. Democrats and Republicans and President W. Bush signed it. We never built that fence. Hillary Clinton voted for that bill. A ton of the Democrats in the Senate and the House voted for the bill, maybe a majority of them. And I think Obama was then a U.S. senator. He probably voted for it.
He voted now, present.
Hillary, is that what he voted? Okay,
yeah, he voted present. Present.
Well, hey, that is, for Obama, that's a real commitment. So you had all these Democrats voting for the bill, including Hillary Clinton. Today, you couldn't drag them to that vote with a team of horses for this reason. This is exactly the same as all the Democrats deciding they were going to be against missile defense because Ronald Reagan was for it. And Reagan said, I think we should stop incoming missiles before they hit our cities. I think that might be a good idea. Every Democrat against it, except for one or two very conservative, strong defense Democrats. They made a decision to all stick together politically. And so these casualties that we're taking, these Americans, these tens of thousands of Americans who are getting hurt, physically hurt by crimes, by people that come in illegally. And, you know, about 22% of all the inmates in federal prison are illegal aliens. So along with those nice groups of families that are shown on ABC and CBS, there's some really hardened, tough people who have murdered people, robbed people, raped people coming in, and they hurt Americans. I think Texas is the only state that actually keeps statistics. But what the Democrats have determined as a party is that those are acceptable casualties. Those Americans who are hurt by those people are acceptable casualties. Ironically, the other acceptable casualties is the approximately 200 illegal aliens per year, men, women, and children who die of thirst in the Arizona, right, California, New Mexico desert because the smuggler tells them that the road is a mile to the north of the border and it may be 20 miles. The next day at 10 o'clock, they're starting to lose consciousness. So those people die, and thousands of Americans are hurt and have property damage and physical damage by bad people that come in. And the Democrat Party, as a strategy, has determined those are acceptable casualties. They're just like a general who is told, you can take this particular objective, but we're going to lose 10,000 men. And he looks at it and analyzes it and says, let's do it. Let's attack. And so you'll see all kinds of vague defenses by the Democrats. For example, the standard one is, well, if you're not for a wall, what are you for? And they say, well, I'll vote for more electronic equipment to surveil things. That's the throwaway line. And as you know, right now, people are coming across. They're approaching the Border Patrol when they get across. And
they're surrendering.
Reading them the scripted. Yeah, they're reading the script that their lawyers gave them and saying, I'm a victim of. Exactly. So they're coming across and surrendering to the Border Patrol. So, no, the Democrat Party's made a decision. They think these people are going to vote for them in big numbers. And so it's sad.
Congressman, we have to take the last break of the hour. And when we come back, we're going to take a quick question from Ingrid. You're listening to Inside Track. You are listening to the man who was the member of Congress who proposed to build the 800 miles of fence. This is the man right here, Duncan Hunter Sr. Welcome back to Inside Track. We have Bridget, who's been Ingrid, who's been on the phone waiting for a chance to come on to the show. Ingrid, a quick question for former Congressman Duncan Hunter.
Yes. Are you aware? I have two, actually. Are you aware that in the year about 2006, there was a speaker at the University of Arizona in the Duval Auditorium who, toward the end of his speech, said that it is our intention to Hispanize the entire Western Hemisphere. And the behavior of the people who are coming across the border illegally is so arrogant and bold that there are no words to describe it. And this is the intention. The man said it in public to an auditorium with a few hundred people. The other thing I'd like to say, and you touched on it when you talked about electronic surveillance, I've been recommending that we use drones all across our border and have some very well-fortified outposts with people in them where people can get first aid or be taken in custody, that kind of thing. What do you think about all that? I'll hang up. Thank you very much for a good lecture.
Thank you, Ingrid. Congressman?
Okay, well, yeah, it sounded like a number of points were made there. I didn't understand the last question that she asked there.
I think Ingrid was trying to find out your opinion on use of drones for border protection.
Okay. Yeah, here's a problem. The problem is it's kind of like when we tried to get the border fence built and the Bush administration this had W's fingerprints on it because he didn't want to build the border fence even after he signed the bill. They came up with the idea of doing a virtual fence, and that is using electronic signals, which is what drones do. Drones have some value because if they're up high, they can see people as they approach the border, so you can be prepared when they get to the border. But you have to have structure. And when we have, if you just have a way to alert people and you don't have the structure, you don't have the fence, then you're going to lose that 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes that it takes people, for example, in a urban area like San Diego, to get across. They jump into a waiting van or bus or car, and boom, they're going up a freeway and disappear into the interior. So drones are fine, but they only complement the structure itself. You've got to have what the double fence does is it slows them down. And if you've got border patrolmen patrolling in the road that is between the two fences, they can apprehend these people as they try to get over the second fence. And so what it does, it gives them a window, gives our people a window to be able to apprehend them. If you simply rely on drones and you have a response force on the other side, you got to look at the history of this virtual fence that they put up with electronics, where they were telling border patrolmen in the dark of night, you got to go 50 yards to the left. They're coming through, and these guys are bouncing across irrigation ditches and going through the brush, and their laptops are hitting the ceiling of their patrol cars. You have to have the structure. It's just like no president has ever taken down the wall around the White House, right?
Right.
They understand fences and walls work, and so the drones are good if you use them as a complement to the structure, but you have to have the structure.
Congressman, you probably know as much as anyone around about the importance of border enforcement. What advice would you give the president who's in the process of changing leadership at DHS and other departments under Homeland Security?
He's got to use something, and this is something that Duncan sent to him, a recommendation which was right on target. We got 10 divisions of U.S. Army personnel, and you don't use them to go down with their weapons and simply do some logistical stuff supporting the Border Patrol. Each one of those divisions has an engineering unit, a big engineering unit. They have bulldozers, they have road graders, they have scrapers, they have water trucks, they have rollers, they have everything you need to build a road or a foundation. half the cost of building the border fence is building the foundation under it, because you basically are cutting a roadbed through mountains and hills and across desert, and then you build the fence on top of it. When we built the fence across Smuggler's Gulch in San Diego, most of our cost of building the fence was cutting and filling the canyons we went through and then put the fence on top of that. That was most of our cost. So he could use, the president could use right now, existing equipment that the taxpayers have already paid for in these engineering units in each one of our Army divisions and the Marine Corps and the Seabees. And maybe you don't take it from the 82nd Airborne, because they're like a 911 force that's got to be able to go and take their engineering units with them if they have to deploy quickly. But you could use this massive capability we have, where we already have operators, and a six-piece, 10-man force can build about a quarter mile of what I call foundational road a day. The president ought to be doing that right now as commander-in-chief, without having to get appropriations from Congress, because he's got operational money. In fact, it's great training. I brought in the National Guard and the Army Reservists to weld our fence and build our foundational road and build the fence. And it's great training for them. So you're already paying for these people. So instead of driving their bulldozer around in a circle every month to get some training up at Fort Hood, they go down to the border at Fort Bliss and they deploy in teams, and they start building foundational road and fence. That's what we should be doing right now. And, you know, they just had a decision I saw in the newspaper today. I don't know if you saw
I've seen it. I was just going to ask you the question about
yeah.
it. A federal judge
has... They got the left-wing court in the Ninth Circuit
yep.
to say the president can't build the border fence.
Yep. Yeah.
I think that'll be overridden when they move it to saner ground, when they move up to another court. But nonetheless, what he ought to be doing right now is using the military, which does have explicit authority under the Drug Enforcement Acts, to assist in building structure at the border that will inhibit smuggling.
Well, the situation with obstruction all through the courts and even in Congress and the departments is just incredible. We got 2 minutes and 45 seconds before the end of the hour. You know, Congressman, I always pack about 12 pounds of poop into an 8-pound poop bag when we do this show with questions. I probably packed 20 pounds of questions here and only got to about 4 pounds of them. Let me ask you this question. Some say sure. that Donald Trump is using scorched earth tactics to resist efforts to destroy his presidency. Do you blame him? And you agree with AG Barr that the Obama administration spied on the Trump campaign, and that there's been an effort to nullify Trump's election and subvert the chief executive by some high-placed government officials and the left?
Yeah. Let me just start by saying that when Obama won, this is the difference between Democrats and Republicans. When Obama won, I'd been out campaigning hard for Obama. That Sunday, I went to Trinity Baptist Church with our late pastor, Bob Winterton, and he, who was a hardcore conservative who campaigned against Obama, he led us all in prayer for the new president of the United States, Barack Obama, because he was our president. And so Republicans and conservatives, when they lose, they pray for the success of the president who happens to come from the other party. Now, when I thought about that, I thought about us all there in church praying for President Obama. Maybe some of us weren't as sincere as we were trying to be. But I was thinking about that when I was standing watching the rioters in Washington, D.C. the day after Donald Trump was inaugurated. So we pray for the other side to be successful, because it is our country and we want him to succeed for our country's sake. And the other guys go out and immediately riot against a duly enacted presidential selection process, and so that's the difference. And so, the greatest thing about Donald Trump, he's got the skin of a rhino. I mean, he's tough, and you have to be tough. And the idea that the Democrats pivoted immediately after no Russian collusion was found, they immediately pivoted into something else. They have a strategy session. They said, what's number two? And if that goes down, what's number three? It won't stop.
Congressman Hunter.
We got to learn to live with it.
We're up against it. Thank you very much for appearing with us. Until next week, when Tom Danahy will sit in my chair as I visit the historic D-Day beaches. For Inside Track, this is Bruce Ash.
And Eb Wilkinson.
Wishing you a very good afternoon.